The Assassin.
You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest. You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest.
What up, y'all? You're listening to Sports Talk with Trop, and I'm your host, Katie Trop. Well, let's kick it right off with the results of UFC 277 this weekend. My girl Amanda Nunes, she got her title back. She won it in a round five decision against Juliana Pena, and it was a good fight. They both women put up a great, spectacular fight, but Nunes did what I expected her to do. I expected her to go back to the drawing board because she obviously didn't have any major issues fighting against Pena. There wasn't really anything other than what was happening is that Pena was just wearing her down. And I think she took her by surprise because I don't think Nunes expected to get what she got from Pena in the first matchup. And so basically what was going on is Nunes was just throwing heat. She was putting a lot of oomph behind every punch that she had in the first matchup, and it really wore her out. And then it just ended up that Pena was able to wear her down and eventually get her to submit. And so that's how she won the first matchup. But the second matchup, it was a battle between both of them. I mean, neither one of them got knocked out, but definitely Nunes, she dominated the fight in every round, I would say. Pena got knocked down quite a few times. Both of their faces were messed the fuck up afterwards as well. So they both, you could tell they both went five rounds. It was a good fight. And, now Nunes is, back to the champ, back to the bantamweight champ as, right where she should be. So it should be interesting to see where, who both of these fighters end up fighting next. But, it was a great matchup between the two of them, and it really didn't go, I'm really not shocked with how it ended up, just because I really didn't expect Nunes to knock her out, and you could kind of tell that's what she wasn't really going for the knockout this time. She was like, you could tell that she's like, I got to wear her down, and I got to take her five rounds, and if I happen to get a good punch in and knock her out, then great, or if I happen to get her to submit somehow, great, but I just need to make sure I just keep her just wear her down, and she just kept going in, and Nunes is back on top. So it was a great fight by both women for sure. All right, now let's move on to some NFL talk this weekend, starting off with my Dallas Cowboys are still the most valuable franchise in all of the world. They are now valued at $7.64 billion. So the Cowboys can't win shit, but we're definitely worth shit. So that just goes to show, man, Dallas Cowboys fans are legit. We're not a bunch of bandwagon, fake-ass motherfuckers like the majority of sports fans out there. We actually ride or die for our team, even though they suck fucking ass. We still consume Cowboys football at a high level. We still buy the merch. We still go to the games and sell out the games. We just can't get shit done. We just can't win. And it would be nice to hopefully change that around this year, but it doesn't matter that they can't win because they're still the most valuable franchise on the face of this planet. As a matter of fact, the franchise right behind them is actually the New York Yankees at $7 billion. So the Cowboys are still worth, $64 million. I don't know. I can't do math. Regardless, they're worth a lot more than the Yankees. And that says a lot because the Yankees are one of the most storied franchises as well. And they actually do win. So good for the Cowboys. And actually, as a matter of fact, 16 of the 32 NFL teams are worth over, they're either worth $4 billion or more. So that's just crazy the NFL, sports franchises in general, that's one of the best investments you can make if you're a wealthy motherfucker like these guys and gals, because there are some women owners out there. But yeah, and I was also reading in that same exact article that that all the NFL franchises, I think over the last like 10 years or so, they've increased their wealth by 18% every single year. So their return on investment is it's out there, man. So you definitely want to own a sports franchise if you got the money. And so the actually the top five most valuable franchises in the NFL, obviously, like I said, number one, Dallas Cowboys at $7.64 billion. Then at number two in the NFL would be the LA Rams. They're valued at $5.91 billion. So they're a couple billion below the Cowboys, but it definitely helps. That's why they moved to LA, because look at what happened. They are now worth $5.91 billion. If they were still in St. Louis, I don't think they would be worth that much. They might be in the $4 billion range or a little bit lower, but they're worth a lot more being in L.A. Then number three, the New England Patriots at $5.88 billion. Then number four, the New York Giants at $5.73 billion. And then rounding out the top five are the San Francisco 49ers at $5.18 billion. And then actually the least valuable franchise in the NFL is the Cincinnati Bengals, but they're worth $2.84 billion. So while they haven't reached the $4 billion mark, they're still in the billions. So yeah, if you're able to purchase a franchise, a sports franchise, especially an NFL franchise, you may want to make that investment, because it's a good investment to make. Also, somebody who's getting a piece of this cheddar is Deebo Samuel. He finally was able to sign his extension with the San Francisco 49ers this week. They signed him to a three-year, $73.5 million extension, and $58.1 million of that is guaranteed money. So good for you, Deebo Samuel. Definitely well-deserved. He's also kind of in the same situation that DK Metcalf was in, is that now that Jimmy Garoppolo's gone, who the hell knows what kind of production you're going to get out of Deebo Samuel now, just because he's got a different quarterback. So his production level may stay the same, or it may falter off. And regardless, he's guaranteed $58.1 million. So definitely well-deserved, and that's good for the 49ers that they locked him in, because he's a huge part of their offense and why they've played so well over the last couple of seasons. All right, and then the last bit of NFL news, which broke today, is we finally have a ruling on Deshaun Watson and how many games he's going to be suspended. The judge announced today that she has ruled that Deshaun Watson should get a 6-game suspension. Not a lot of people are happy about this. Of course, I'm sure Deshaun Watson is. I'm sure the Cleveland Browns are, because they probably expected him to miss a lot more time. I mean, it was really up in the air how much time he was going to lose. But I actually just read the entire 16-page document from the judge. And it actually, her ruling actually makes quite a bit of sense. Now, first of all, in my personal opinion, I've already stated, I believe the women. I believe Deshaun Watson did what he's accused of. I also believe he didn't deserve to be held criminally responsible, because I don't think dangling your dick on massage therapist is warrants you being put behind bars criminally. I don't believe in just putting people behind bars for that kind of stuff. But he definitely deserved to lose money in all of this. I'm happy that he's lost a bunch of civil lawsuits, or paid off. He hasn't actually lost any of them. He's paid all but one off now at this point. But regardless, he deserves to lose the money. He deserves to have to pay for it. And he also deserves a suspension as well. I don't think 6 games is enough. I was kind of hoping he was going to get at least half the year, or the entire season, just because of the allegations. I mean, if you really look at what's gone on in the NFL of the guys who've been investigated, I know a lot of people want to compare this to the Ben Roethlisberger thing, but really what happened with Ben Roethlisberger is only one woman accused him. Now, granted, one woman accused him of rape, and that's horrifying, but there weren't any other allegations. After that, a whole landfall of allegations didn't come after that, and he got what he got. This with Deshaun Watson, it was allegation after allegation after allegation. It got up to 24, and even in that New York Times article, it looks like it got up to about 60 of women that he reached out to. So obviously something happened here. And I thought it warranted a lot more suspension than this. But really, when I actually went and read the entire 16-page document of why the judge made the decision she made, it's actually the NFL's own fault why he only is getting a 6-game suspension, because that's the parameters they set. Their actual rules are, if you get in trouble your first time, you're getting a 6-game suspension. And then after that, they start to, they'll accrue and you can be suspended more. And really, if you compare it to, you know, Ray Rice, when he knocked his girlfriend, who's now his wife, when he knocked her out in an elevator, he at first got 2 games and then they bumped it up to 4 games. Then you had, I can't remember the defensive end's name. Greg Hardy, the defensive end. He was the defensive end of the Carolina Panthers, and then he played for the Cowboys for a season as well. He was accused of domestic violence multiple times, and he was only suspended for 8 games. And there's been a couple others out there, basically in the same category, and they really only get the 6-game suspension. So that's kind of the parameters. Those are the parameters that have been set by the NFL over the years. So it's really their own fault that they didn't get the year, because the NFL was going after a year. That's what they wanted. They wanted him to be suspended for the entire season. But the judge basically said, like, there's no precedent that's ever been set where you suspend a guy for an entire year. That was the NFLPA's argument, and also Deshaun Watson's argument. And the NFL's argument against that was that, well, these are unprecedented allegations as well, which are both true, but at the same time, the rules are, you break the rules in these parameters, which there were a few parameters, so I'm not going to go through everything that I read in the 16-page document, but basically, these are the parameters, and we have set it at 6 games, and so that's what he got, was the 6 games, which is on par with the NFL, and I know a lot of people are bringing up the Falcons receiver who was just recently suspended for the entire year because he gambled. But the difference is there's different rules for gambling, and gambling actually affects the NFL and their bottom line and their business. And I'm sorry, that's all the NFL cares about is money. They really don't give a shit who the players are, if they're good, if they're bad, and really neither do the fans. This is really just, most people just like to complain, and then we'll be on to the next one with that, whatever the next story is. But in my opinion, after I read the judge's ruling and why she ruled the way she ruled, is because those are the rules. The NFL has set these rules. I do expect the NFL, both the NFL and the NFLPA have 3 days to appeal this decision. The NFLPA has said they're not going to appeal it, but I expect the NFL to do so since they wanted a whole year. I expect Roger Goodell to appeal it, and then he's probably going to give a longer suspension. And if that happens, then the NFLPA is probably going to sue the NFL, and then we're going to go to federal court, and that's going to take a couple of months. So it's possible that, this Deshaun Watson thing, it's not over, but it's very possible that he may actually play the beginning of the season, and they'll go through this federal court system, and they'll get to a ruling maybe in like October or November, and then that's when his suspension will start, will be after that. So we don't know if he's starting the season off suspended or not, because it's all just going to depend on what happens with the NFL. But I do expect them to appeal it. I expect them to give him a longer suspension. I don't know, though, if they will go the full year. I know that's what they wanted, but they might bump it up, I would say, maybe to like 10 games, 12 games, but still the NFLPA is probably still going to sue them regardless, even if they don't take the 6-game suspension. But regardless, we finally have a decision and a ruling on what happened with Deshaun Watson here. It's definitely not the end of it. But like I said, I read the whole 16-page document. She laid it out very simply, very easily, and it's basically the NFL has set the parameters at 6 games if this is your first offense, and this is Deshaun Watson's first offense. So regardless of how many offenses he had in this one offense, it still is within the parameters of the rule to get him suspended for 6 games. So, like I said, there's a good possibility he's going to be starting week one. But there's also a good possibility, regardless, he's definitely going to be suspended for 6 games, 100%. It just doesn't, we just don't know yet when those 6 games will be served, whether it's going to be at the beginning of the season for the first 6 weeks, or if we're going to end up going to court, and it could be sometime mid-season. But we'll keep you posted on the Deshaun Watson dick dangling suspension here. All right, so let's move on to baseball and the top 10 MLB power rankings. Actually, before we get to the power rankings, the trade deadline is coming up. We have 24 hours exactly left of the trade deadline. And so actually a couple of trades have gone down actually today. Actually all three trades that I've written down have happened today. The first one being, I was actually really shocked to see this trade happen, but the San Diego Padres ended up trading for the Milwaukee Brewers closer, Josh Hader, who's been one of the best closers in the league for about 2-3 seasons now. So this is a good move for San Diego because their bullpen has been okay. They did trade away their current closer in exchange for Hader. So I think this definitely helps them. But I think it was kind of weird for the Brewers just because he's been a huge part of their team. He's been I just was really shocked that they traded him because they look like they're actual contenders. And, you know, you don't really need a great closer to win a World Series or some playoff games, but it definitely helps. And so I was shocked that the Brewers ended up doing this trade, but good for the Padres. Then the Houston Astros, they ended up trading for Trey Mancini of the Baltimore Orioles. So this just makes their offense even better. I also read right before I signed on air here is they also traded for the catcher from the Red Sox, Christian Vasquez, as well. So Houston's bolstering up their offense. But then also the New York Yankees made a big trade today for Montas, the pitcher of the Oakland A's. So they got Frankie Montas in a trade today, and this bolsters their starting pitching. Which I think is where their main issue has been, in my opinion. I don't think it's really they don't have any problems offensively, but they definitely needed some help, some depth with their pitching. They do have a solid starting pitching. They do have a solid bullpen, but to add one more really good starting pitcher, I think that's good for them. So. That happened with some trades today. And, you know, Juan Soto, he's still out there. Who knows what's going to happen with him. There's a lot of rumors of where he's going to end up. But it's looking more and more like he's going to be traded any minute now. So we'll see what happens there. I'll probably have some update on that on Friday, I imagine. And then just in some also random baseball news, Trevor Story, the shortstop of the Boston Red Sox, he fractured his wrist and he's out indefinitely. So the Red Sox are reeling right now. They haven't been playing good baseball at all this second half. And this really takes a huge hit out of their offense. And so the Red Sox, I don't think that's going to help them at all in this tough division that they're in. All right, so let's move on to the top 10 MLB power rankings. Not too many shakeups this week. As a matter of fact, the top two is the same, and a little tiny shakeup there in 3 and 4, but not much movement this week. So number one, once again, the stupid ass Los Angeles Dodgers. Number one this week. They're 68-33 overall record, 7-3 in their last 10 games. This past week, they played the Rockies and the Washington Nationals. And, of course, they had a rookie debut yesterday, a guy named Outman. And his debut, he walks right up to the plate and hits a home run. And he actually had 3 hits yesterday with 3 runs, so he had a great debut. So as if the Dodgers couldn't get any fucking better, their rookie comes right up and he just walks right up and hits one out of the park. You still got Trey Turner. He's on something like a 16, 17, 18 game hitting streak right now. And then you got Freddie Freeman, who's still having a phenomenal season. And their starting pitching continues to dominate as well. So the Dodgers still at number one on my top 10, which just is very upsetting to me. Then at number two on my top 10 MLB power rankings of the Houston Astros, overall record of 67-36, 6-4 in their last 10 games. This past week, they played the Seattle Mariners and the Oakland A's. Yordan Alvarez, he had a huge walk-off hit yesterday. He's actually had a huge week. He's hit the 30 home run plateau. He's only behind Aaron Judge in home runs right now. Jose Altuve, he had yet another great week. And then Justin Verlander, he still is dominating this league, and he leads the league with the most wins right now. Then at number three on my top 10 MLB power rankings of the New York Mets, they are on a tear right now. They are 64-37 overall record, 7-3 in their last 10 games, but they are in a six-game winning streak, which is the longest winning streak in baseball right now. This week they played the Marlins and the Yankees, and they owned both of them. Taiwan Walker, he continues to be a dark horse for them with their starting pitching. He had a huge game yesterday. Pete Alonso, he continues to rake and make a huge case for himself for the NL MVP this year. And then Francisco Lindor, he's just quietly having another phenomenal season as well. Then at number four, the Yankees fell another spot. Their overall record is 69-34, so they still have the best record in the league. But their last couple of weeks, they've been pretty mediocre. They're 5-5 in their last 10 games. This week, they played the Royals and the Mets. But Aaron Judge, he's had a great week. He still leads the league in home runs. Anthony Rizzo has also had another great week. He had a huge hit yesterday, but it ended up being for nothing because the Royals ended up winning the game. But he came right up, and he's just been hitting home runs like no other this year. DJ LeMahieu is also, he's been getting hot as well. And then Matt Carpenter, man, ever since the Yankees signed him, I don't know what's been going on with him, but he just can't miss. So the Yankees offensively, they're looking great. The starting pitching is, like I said, not bad at all. And then just adding Montas into the starting pitching lineup is just going to be huge for them. So we'll see if they can move up. But, I mean, falling to number four is not a big deal. It's mostly just because this past week. And they did get beat by some good teams. They got beat by the Mets. And then even before that, you know, last week they got beat by the Astros as well. So they've been getting beat by some good teams. Then at number five on my top five MLB power rankings of the Atlanta Braves, overall record of 62-41, 6-4 in their last 10 games, and they're on a three-game winning streak. They actually just swept the Diamondbacks this weekend. They also played the Phillies earlier in the week. But the big guy this week, who you didn't really expect it to be, is Austin Riley, who's just had a phenomenal season. He actually broke a record this month. For the most extra base hits in 1 month for the Atlanta Braves with 26, which was previously owned by Hank Aaron with 25. So that's a pretty big deal when you break a record owned by Hank Aaron, one of the greatest baseball players of all time. Actually, right after that, he ended up signing a 10-year, $212 million extension with the Atlanta Braves. So Austin Riley is locked in with the Braves for right now. And obviously that's well-deserved because Riley has been probably the quietest NL MVP candidate, I would say, just because, you know, you've got Pete Alonso having such a phenomenal year, and you got Paul Goldschmidt with the Cardinals having such a phenomenal year, that you're not really hearing much about Austin Riley. But Austin Riley has been having one hell of a year on a really great team. But, I mean, he's got so much talent surrounding him that he kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But, hey, whatever. He just signed a $212 million extension, so he's getting paid. So who the fuck cares? And then you also have Fried, who he came out and had a great start the other day as well. So their starting pitching has really turned it on. They started out the season real shaky, but they are back to championship form in Atlanta. Then at number six on my top 10 MLB power rankings of the Toronto Blue Jays, overall record of 57-45, 8-2 in their last 10 games. This past week, they played the Detroit Tigers and the St. Louis Cardinals. Their pitcher Berrios, man, he had a hell of an outing where he pitched for seven innings and had six strikeouts. So he's been on fire. Vlad Guerrero Jr., he's just continued his domination behind the plate. Chapman, Chapman and Bichette both had huge weeks this week where they had game-winning runs and set their team up for some big wins this past week. So the Blue Jays are at number six, and they continue to be a very solid and very quiet team that nobody's really talking about in the East who could make some noise come playoff time. Then at number seven on my top 10 MLB power rankings, the Milwaukee Brewers, overall record of 57-45, 7-3 in their last 10 games. This past week, they played the Boston Red Sox and the Minnesota Twins. And Hunter Renfro continues to rake. You know, his first, like, what, 4 or 5 games back, he had home runs in each one of them. And then this week, he had 4 hits in one game. He had a couple game winners, a couple home runs. So Renfro, he continues to be an offensive force for the Milwaukee Brewers. Then at number 8 on my top 10 MLB power rankings of the Philadelphia Phillies, overall record of 55-47, 6-4 in their last 10 games. And they're on a 5-game winning streak, so they're right behind the Mets. This week they played the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Atlanta Braves. Kyle Schwarber, he continues to rake. He has 33 home runs. Alec Baum, he is having a great couple of months. He's really been under the radar. You really haven't heard about him. But I just was looking up some of his stats, and he's batting like a .299, and he's on he was on like a huge not a huge streak, but a pretty decent sized hitting streak the other last couple of weeks. So he's been a quiet offensive force for them. And then their catcher Real Muto, he has also had a great week as well. So the Phillies, they continue to upset some people right now. So we'll see what happens come playoff time if they're able to keep this up. But it's pretty shocking that the Phillies were able to fire their manager midseason and then go on this tear. And now they're actually a legit playoff contender in a very difficult division as well. Then at number 9 on my top 10 MLB power rankings at the St. Louis Cardinals, overall record of 54-48, 6-4 in their last 10 games. This past week they played the Washington Nationals and the Toronto Blue Jays, who they took 2 of 3 from in Toronto, so that was a big deal for them this week. But they had a new starting pitcher come out this week. Well, he wasn't really new, but I've never heard of his name. But he came right out, Andre Pallante, and he came out and had 8 strikeouts in 8 innings in a game yesterday. But then who's had the big week for the Cardinals this week is actually shockingly not Goldschmidt. It is Corey Dickerson. He's basically had a hit or a big play or a home run in every game that they've played this week. So hats off to Corey Dickerson, where it looked like his career was kind of on the downslide, but he's had a resurgence the last couple of weeks for sure. Then in rounding out my top 10 MLB power rankings, the Chicago White Sox, overall record of 51-50, 6-4 in their last 10 games. This week they played the Oakland A's and the Colorado Rockies. And, you know, their offense has really got going with Jose Abreu and Eloy Jimenez. I don't know what the hell's gotten into them, but offensively they've really taken off. But pitching, their starting pitching is pretty good too. Their starting pitcher, Dylan Cease, through 11 games, this is the second lowest ERA since 1913. He has a 42 ERA. Yeah, a 0.42 ERA through 11 games. So that's pretty goddamn good right there. So the White Sox, while they started off the season like shit, now they're actually really starting to pick it up, and they could be one of those second half teams who really gets going and ends up sneaking into the playoffs. And you didn't really think that was going to happen with the way the season started for them. All right, and so yeah, that rounds us out on baseball. So today's show we're going to end with a top 5. Unfortunately, yesterday the great legendary Bill Russell passed away at the age of 88, the legendary Boston Celtics player, probably the first ever NBA superstar of all time, one of the most decorated NBA superstars of all time, and hands down one of the greatest basketball players of all time, also a great human as well. But he died yesterday. He was an 11-time NBA champion. He's a 5-time MVP, 12-time All-Star, 4-time rebound, rebound champion. His career statistics are points, 14,522. He averaged 15.1 points per game. Then career rebounds, 21,620. He averaged 22.5 rebounds per game for his career. And then assists, career assists, he had 4,100. And he averaged 4.3 assists per game. So obviously, and there's even more. Like, honestly, you can't even really name off his resume because it's so long. It was actually really difficult to try and find five moments, because at first what I was going to do is I was going to rank all of his championships, but that was difficult to do because, for one, obviously he played in the early 50s and the 60s, and I was not born then, so I did not actually even get to watch those finals. Hell, there's not even a lot of footage of Bill Russell's career because this was even before anybody really filmed anything. And, you know, NBA wasn't really as big as it was today. So there's even so much footage of Bill Russell that we haven't even seen. So we don't even really know what his greatness is because we're missing so much of it. But obviously, he was one of the greatest basketball players of all time, hands down. And so I did come up with five. It was really, really difficult to do. But basically, what I did is I chose, like, one of his MVP seasons. I chose what I feel is probably the best championship season he had. And then just a couple of other highlights throughout a season, because really, if you have never looked up Bill Russell, I mean, obviously, if you've been listening to the show, I've sung my praises about Bill Russell many times. That's really why I didn't have to rattle off on his stats, because I've rattled off on a bunch of his stats many times on the show. And I haven't been doing this show. I've only been doing the show since January. So to discuss Bill Russell and his greatness multiple times and only been doing this show half a year is, it says a lot about what a player he is. And so obviously I've already discussed a lot of his stats and a lot of the things he's accomplished. But, I felt like I had to at least do a top five on him because he was legendary. So let's go ahead and start it off with the number five, top five Bill Russell moment. Would be in 1957-1958 season. That was his second season in the league. His first season, unfortunately, was cut short due to an injury. Not just an injury, but also he started the season late because he was playing in the Olympics as well. So he didn't start the season until, I think, like December. But anyways, in his second season, the Celtics started the season off with 14 straight wins. In one game, he actually set an NBA record for the most rebounds in one half, which was 32 rebounds in the first half, and he actually ended up with 49 rebounds overall. And in that season, he would end up averaging 22.7 rebounds per game. The Celtics would end up with a league-leading record of 49-23. He would end up winning the MVP that year. And that was his first MVP because, like I said, that was the second season of his career, and he already won the MVP, so that says a lot. But unfortunately, in the finals, they would end up facing the St. Louis Hawks, who would end up winning the finals, but that's because Bill Russell would end up getting injured in Game 3 of the finals. And once he was injured, you know, it was 1-1 going into Game 3, and then he got injured. The Hawks took that game. And I think they ended up winning in six games. So, but obviously the Celtics' play took a huge toll after Bill Russell was injured. And that is one of the only losses Bill Russell ever suffered as in the NBA Finals. He played in 13 seasons and won 11 NBA Finals. So that just right there tells you what an amazing basketball player he was. He was on some great Boston Celtics teams, but don't get it twisted. It all revolved around Bill Russell. He was the dude. So moving on to number four, top five Bill Russell moments, is 1966-1967 season was when he first took over as the coach of the Boston Celtics. So not only did he play for this team, because Red Auerbach, he retired, and I can't recall. There were two other players, or two other ex-players or ex-coaches that they wanted to take. He wanted them to take over as coach, and they didn't want the job. And so it just ended up going to Bill Russell. And so not only was he a player, but he was a coach at the same time. So he was the first player coach, or he was a player coach, but he was the first black coach ever as well. So that was a big monumental thing for the NBA, because not only was he a player coach, but he was the first black coach. So I thought that was a huge deal, and that definitely needed to make this list. But in he was a player coach for three seasons, and in those three seasons, the first season, they would end up not making the NBA Finals. I think they would lose to the 76ers in the Eastern Conference Finals. But then the 2 years after that, they would go on to go to the NBA Finals and beat my Los Angeles Lakers. So those are huge accomplishments by Bill Russell to win his last two championships as a player and a coach at the exact same time. Then at number three on my top five Bill Russell moments, I have the 1959 championship versus my Lakers. I believe they were in Minnesota at the time, though. They were not in L.A. yet. But they got swept. And the reason why I put this championship on here is because this was the first championship that began the eight championship run that the Celtics would go on, where they would win eight straight championships. And in this NBA Finals, Bill Russell would set the finals record of averaging 29.5 rebounds per game. And they, like I said, they would go on to win and sweep. And I really just put this on here because this was the first and the beginning of really of the greatness that was Bill Russell. Then number two on my top five Bill Russell moments, I'm just calling it the rebounding king. He was the rebounding king. He was really known for his rebounds and his defense. As you know, today's league is very offense heavy. It's actually been offense heavy for quite some time. It even, when I read about when Bill Russell came up in the league, you could tell that they even would try to say that he's going to become obsolete because the offensive game is just growing. But it didn't matter. His career was great all 13 years. But he was the rebounding king, and he had many instances where he was the rebounding king. I mean, I just told you that he did set the NBA record for 32 rebounds in the first half. So that was an NBA record for the most rebounds in a half in the NBA, and that still rings true today. Also, probably the most stellar performance he had rebound-wise was on February 3rd, 1960, versus Syracuse Nationals, not a team anymore. He had 51 rebounds, which at the time was a record, but then Wilt Chamberlain would eventually come in. I think it would be 10, 11 years later when Wilt Chamberlain would ultimately break that record, and he would end up with 55 rebounds in one game. But the stat line for this game for him was he had 51 rebounds, 23 points, and 5 assists. So that was a huge game for him. Then also in the 1960 Finals, Game 2, he had 40 rebounds, which is a Finals record. And then, like I said, he had the 32 rebounds in the first half of the finals in 1958. He was also a four-time rebound NBA rebound champion in 1958, 1959, 1964, 1965. And then he averaged 20 rebounds per game for 10 of his 13 seasons that he played in the NBA. So, and then, like I had stated before, his career playoff. His career rebounding is 21,620. And then his career playoff rebounds, which is a record, which is the most, is 4,104. So he was the rebounding king. He was also amazing on defense, but he was definitely known for rebounds. Then at number one on my top five Bill Russell moments, it is the 1963 season. He would win his fourth MVP This is, he actually considers the team after this, the following season, to be the greatest of all time. But in my personal opinion, I think this one is, just for what they had to go through to get to the NBA Finals. But in this 1963 season, he got his first triple-double ever against the New York Knicks. And his stat line for that triple-double was 17 points, 19 rebounds, and 10 assists. And he would end up winning his sixth straight finals in 1963, in which they would beat my Los Angeles Lakers in six games. In which his shining moment was in game three, where he had 21 points, 38 rebounds, and six assists. So I think that 1963 championship and that season was probably his best, even though it's really difficult to decide what is his best, because out of all of his 13 seasons, he was great. Like I said, his rookie season was really the only one that was cut short. And then his second season, they would go to the NBA Finals and they would lose because of his injury in the postseason. But I mean, overall, he was so dominating. It was basically a battle between him and Wilt Chamberlain on who had the most rebounds. And you know, Wilt Chamberlain, he scored a lot of points, so he was kind of the flashy player. But I mean, Bill Russell was always all reliable. And you really got to give it up to Bill Russell, because he really did, even though, you know, a lot of people give him his praise right now. And a lot of people talk about his greatness now. While he was playing with Boston, he did not feel the love. And even when his time ended with Boston, he did not feel the love. He just got his statue like, what, in 2013, 2011, something like that. And within the last like 15 years, which to me is egregious, just because he literally is not only one of the greatest basketball players of all time, but he's definitely one of the most legendary Boston Celtics of all time. And so it's very shocking when you actually read into the past of what it was like for him coming up, because it wasn't the way it is now. Yes, if you are a player in today's game, you do have haters, but they're usually haters from the opposing team. Usually you at least get love from the fans of your own team. But that wasn't really so much the case when he played with the Celtics. And he was pretty much a pariah with the Celtics organization for quite some time, and it was not deserved at all. So I'm happy that towards the end of his life, especially in the last 15, 20-ish years, he's definitely received his accolades, but he did not get those accolades while he was playing. And I actually found this quote from his daughter, because I have mentioned before on a past episode about a horrific experience that he had with some Celtics fans. And I actually found this quote from his daughter that kind of describes the experience even more in depth. So here it is, from Bill Russell's daughter. One night we came home from a three-day weekend and found we had been robbed. Our house was in a shambles, and the N-word was spray-painted on the walls. The burglars had poured beer on the pool table and ripped up the felt. They had broken into my father's trophy case and smashed most of the trophies. I was petrified and shocked at the mess. Everyone was very upset. The police came, and after a while, they left. It was then that my parents pulled back their covers, bed covers, to discover that the burglars had defected in their bed. I mean, defecated. Yes, they shit in their bed. Every time the Celtics went out on the road, vandals would come and tip over our garbage cans. My father went to the police station to complain. The police told him that raccoons were responsible, so he asked where he could apply for a gun permit. The raccoons never came back. The only time we were really scared was after my father wrote an article about racism in professional basketball for the Saturday Evening Post. He earned the nickname Felton X. We received threatening letters, and my parents notified the FBI. What I find most telling about this episode is that years later, after Congress had passed the Freedom of Information Act, my father requested his FBI file and found that he was repeatedly referred to therein as an arrogant Negro who won't sign autographs for white children. And that is actually very true of what you read. Like, I have read that He was very reclusive and wouldn't really talk to a lot of people. And honestly, at the time, I can't blame the guy because that's the way he was treated. So you really not only got to give it up to Bill Russell for being an amazing basketball player, but for being an amazing basketball player while putting up with all that bullshit and literal bullshit in his fucking bed. So, like I said, great basketball player, even better human being for putting up with that shit. And Bill Russell has passed away at the age of 88, but I'm glad he was able to receive his accolades over the last, at least during most of my lifetime, people have discussed Bill Russell in a positive light. So when I read all of that stuff, it was very telling to me because I'm like, wow, that's how you treat your superstars. That's crazy. So, you know, you really got to give it up to him for what he put up with. And he still played great and was a great basketball player for a team and for fans that did not appreciate him. So RIP to Bill Russell. Enjoy the week of sports, guys, and I will talk to you all on Friday.